Accession number 27757, reel 1. Correction, accession number 27767, reel 1.
Adrian Holloway, reel 1. Can you tell me, first of all, where you were born?
I was born in Stroud, Gloucestershire.
And what did your father do?
He read for the bar, and then he became chairman of our family company, Holloway Brothers in Stroud, who were wholesale clothiers.
Right. And where did you go to school?
I first of all went to a prep school called The Hall in Cheshunt in Hertfordshire, and then at the age of 13 I joined the Royal Naval College, Dartmouth.
Right. And did you have any brothers and sisters?
Yes, my brother, he was at Clifton and became a doctor and served as a surgeon lieutenant RNVR during the war.
Right, and his name was?
Michael.
Right, and was he older than you or?
10 years.
10 years older, right.
Yeah.
And any other siblings?
No.
No, right, the two of you. So were you keen to follow him into the Navy? Was that a...
Well, but he hadn't, of course, gone into the Navy by the time I went to Dartmouth, because that was in 1936. Mm. The war hadn't started. But I was keen originally to go into the Navy. Yes, I must be, because I passed the interview, and they always ask you that. I'm afraid that 3.5 years of Dartmouth rather disillusioned me. They pumped Nelson into you for so much that you really got sick of the whole thing.
So you went to Dartmouth in 1936. How old were you then?
13.
Right. And what was it like? Do you remember arriving there?
I remember arriving there very well. We arrived at the station of Dartmouth. It's called a station, but actually it's only served by a ferry to the other side of King's Weir. And the college is about probably a mile from the station. And we had to march for the first time in our lives all the way up the hill to the college. So that was quite a hard introduction to life at the college itself. And the college is a rather beautiful building which dominates the whole town, built by Sir Aston Webb in 1905. It's centenary this year.
And so what was the daily routine like there?
Very, very harsh. You were called up by the porters at 6:30 in the morning. You had to run along to the plunge, which was cold sea water, and you had to plunge into that. If you weren't seen, you could dip your head in and try and kid the cadet captain who'd actually immersed your whole body. Then you had 5 minutes to wash and 5 minutes to dress, then you went down to the mess hall to get hard ship's biscuits and milk, and then you did an hour's work before breakfast. Then there were divisions in the huge parade ground from 9 until about 9:30, during which time you would have also done some PT. And then there was instruction until lunchtime. Then lunch was an hour. And after lunch, there would be what was called clear college, which everybody had to be out regardless of the place, so that the place could be cleaned. Nobody was allowed in for 2 hours. And that was games time. Am I going too fast?
No, that's fine.
You had, as regards games, to do logs. For instance, a mile run up to a place called Norton was half a log. Well, then you had to do half an hour's squash to make up a whole log. Or, of course, a game of rugger was a whole log, and so on. But quite an amusing thing was that on a Friday you could have shooting and haircut, and that counts as a whole log. I never quite knew why. Then there was tea and evening instruction, depending on the season. In the summer, of course, it took place later. And then you had what was called evening quarters, where you were all mustered by houses and divisions on the quarterdeck inside, which was a huge, huge part of the college. And by 9 o'clock, you had to be in bed. And then, I mean, even the, it was extraordinary. The cadet captain would shout out, North side will stand by to open their windows half. And everybody would open the windows half, and the other side would perhaps close theirs. It was all done by numbers. And then the officer of the day would come in with his cohorts in evening dress, bow tie, and black shirt, white shirt. And you would be lying stiffly at attention in bed. By that time, you were quite glad to get to sleep.
All the boys had an interest in going into the Navy, did they? Was very much a preparation for the Navy?
Oh, very much so, yes. It was rather like the Jesuits catching you early. I said to one master, "Sir, why do we come here at 13? And he said, "Well, just that we catch you early." But, of course, later on, you see, I think it was Churchill in the 1920s introduced what was called the special entry scheme, or public school entry scheme, and there would-be cadets took an entrance exam, which was a very stiff one, when they were 18. So they never saw Dartmouth at all. They would go straight to the training cruiser.
So what were the staff like? Were they very strict with you and remote, or...?
Well, indeed, you see, there were two types of staff. You had the naval lieutenants and lieutenant commanders who were in charge of a term. Perhaps I should go back and explain the way that the training was done. When I first went there, the term system was in operation, and you went as a term of 45 cadets, which were all named after admirals. We were the Blakes, and there was St. Vincent and Benbow and so on. And you worked with a term either senior or junior to you. Now, and you were never allowed to speak to anybody senior to you, otherwise you got beaten. Nor could you look into what they called their gun rooms, where they lived. You had to double pass those and keep silent. Well, anyway, the question of who was in charge of them, that would be a serving officer, usually a lieutenant or lieutenant commander. And he would be very much on the promotion ladder. And so, you know, they were very tough on us. We had a man called Lieutenant Peter Gretton. I think I saw him smile twice, and once was a mistake. And, of course, he eventually did frightfully well in the war. He became Vice Admiral Sir Peter Gretton. He was not a bending character at all. Then you had the civilian staff, who were charming because they were not on any promotion ladder, and they would all be ordinary masters who wore civilian clothes and the ordinary garb that a master would wear. The headmaster was a frightening character, E.W. E. Kempson. And his daughter was Rachel Kempson, who, of course, married Michael Redgrave. They'd just married when I was at the college and came down to give a few sketches. And he would have been absolutely appalled at the left-wing antics of his daughter and grandchildren. So he was head of the staff, and head of the college staff would be a captain. Nowadays it's a commodore to keep upstage with the Army and the RAF. Is that enough?
Yeah. Did you enjoy it there?
No. I can't say that I did. I had nothing to compare it with, but it really was so frightfully regimented. It probably in the end did us do a lot of good. There was an Admiral Twiss who became Black Rod after he retired. This is not a digression, but he was captured by the Japanese and had a terrible time. And somebody said to him, how did you cope with all the treatment the Japanese gave you? And he said, well, 3 years at Dartmouth probably helped.
What did your parents feel about you going to Dartmouth? Was it an ambition of theirs that you should join the Navy?
Certainly not my father's. No. I mean, he had no affiliation to the Navy at all, but my parents had a lot of naval friends, and we used to go down to the South Coast and visit them and so on, and I used to go over various ships and this, that, and the other, so I suppose a lot of that helped.
And you had an interest in the Navy and the naval history yourself, did you?
Not so much naval history, because we didn't learn any at my prep school. But it was certainly forced down us at Dartmouth, as I've already said. And in fact, we did the Battle of Trafalgar with models, which was madly boring. And I'm afraid I rather rudely said to the history master, "Sir, why do we do this in the age of steam?" And he said, "Well, history repeats itself," and I didn't pursue the subject.
So, what sort of things did you do during the day? You've given me a bit of an outline, but did you do learn naval skills as well as some classroom skills?
Yes. You never knew where you were going to be in the term syllabus. I mean, you could be doing history for an hour, and then you would be in the gym for an hour. Or you would be squatting on the quarterdeck reading Morse, or doing flags, semaphore, and this, that, and the other. And then there was a special seamanship room where there was a huge model of the forecastle of a ship on which you learnt anchors and cables and all that sort of thing, knots and splices and so on. So a lot of that was done. And then there were huge engineering workshops down at Sankey where you had to go down about 100 steps. And there were these engineering workshops down there. I think the reason was that Admiral Sir John Fisher, Jackie Fisher, the man who dragged the Navy into the 20th century, was keen that engineers should not be looked down on as they were originally, and that cadets should have a good idea of what went on in the engine room, which was fine if it had been more practical. But all that we did was we made a box in the carpenter's shop, we made a spring in one of the other shops, we worked at a lathe, and we did the most boring things in the drawing office. I mean, how may drawing the cross-section of a crankshaft help me to become more acquainted with engineering? I cannot think. Later, when I went to sea as a midshipman, we were pushed through boiler tubes, unfortunately, when the boiler was cold, and went round all the boiler rooms and engine rooms and so on, which in half an hour did more to help our understand what went on in the engine room than anything we did at Sankey in 3.5 years.
Did you do any climbing up masts and knots and ropes?
No. We did climb up ropes in the gym. Yes, that's quite true. And there were parallel bars, which we had to climb up. And incidentally, I did a Royal Command performance in gymnastics, which was, anybody knowing me well, would have taken it somewhat amiss. In 1939, the King and Queen came to Dartmouth in the Royal Yacht Victoria and Albert. And my term was singled out to do a gym performance for them. And so we did this for about 3/4 of an hour. There was not a single command issued. It was all by whistle. And we'd obviously been rehearsing it for ages. And the royal party were very kind and clapped politely at the end. But so I've really done a royal command performance.
It sounds very structured and authoritarian. Were there any ways that you could sort of step over the traces, or, you know, do things you weren't meant to do, nipping off to town or anything like that?
You see, that was very difficult because you were always in uniform. Therefore, you were easily recognised. You couldn't do that. In your final senior year, the senior cadets were allowed to change into a blazer and grey flannels, and then they were allowed to take the train to Churston, which was a delightful little place where there was a golf course, and we were allowed to play golf. And so that was, I suppose, a slight escape from it. We were allowed to have half a pint of cider in the clubhouse, and we thoroughly looked forward to it. There was also one other thing, that there were lots of farms, rather primitive farms, dotted around Dartmouth. And cadets tended to have a farm passed from one term to another, which they were then allowed to walk to on a Sunday afternoon and have a Devon cream tea and smoke, I think, a few cigarettes.
So how long did you stay there?
3.5 years.
Yeah. So you came out in 1939.
Well, no, 1940, I'll tell you what happened. Normally, when a cadet left Dartmouth, he would have gone to the training cruiser, which I mentioned before, and he would have three cruises, one to the Mediterranean, one to the Baltic, and one to the West Indies. And so, of course, you learnt everything from the point of view of how the lower deck lived. You lived as a seaman, in slinging a hammock and everything else. That, of course, was stopped during the war because the cruisers wanted to fight. So the special entry or public school cadets came to Dartmouth, and they were accommodated in the old seaman's barracks down near Sankey. They lived an entirely separate life. They only came to the college for the purposes of Sunday divisions on the quarter deck, on the parade ground. So that's what was suited. So really it came to us that although there were 11 terms you normally did at Dartmouth, I did 12, one of them as this special entry. And that's how Prince Philip came to Dartmouth. He was never a proper Dartmouth cadet. He went there just for this one term instead of the cruiser.
Was he there at the same time as you?
Yes,
was,
yeah, yes. Yeah. Later on, I served in the same ship as a midshipman.
Did he fit in? I mean, he came, as you said, he didn't come in the quite in the normal way. Did he fit in with everybody else, or was he nominated as Mountbatten's protégé? Or
I couldn't answer that question. I don't know, but I imagine he just passed in the normal way. I think so. He certainly got no special treatment as a midshipman.
Right. And did you get on with him well?
I don't think I got to comment on this. I think.
<Fair enough. laughs> So, 1940, and you moved from Dartmouth.
Yes. Well, yeah. You had the passing out exam, which lasted for a fortnight. That was taken in the remotest part of the college, and the whole college had to keep quiet while you took it. It was a very intensive exam. Not only did you do the normal subjects like French and English and so on, but there were hydrostatics, electrics, mechanics, you name it, and engineering, of course. So I managed to pass that. And in August, can I tell you what happened during 1940? On May the 10th, 1940, as everybody knows, the Blitzkrieg started in France. And suddenly, one morning, Dartmouth Harbour was full of French and Belgian and Dutch trawlers, all of whom had come to escape from the German army, and a lot of them had brought their families with them. So we, the special entry and extra term cadets, were ordered to patrol the streets of Dartmouth at night with fixed bayonets. And we didn't really, it was quite Dad's army. It was utterly ridiculous because we didn't know what we were looking for. We'd heard of fifth columnists, but we didn't know what they were. We didn't, supposing that the crafty krauts had been coming along with clogs and Breton hat and onions, we wouldn't have known what on earth they were doing. And there'd never been a curfew in the United Kingdom since about King William's time, and that was enforced there. And we just patrolled the streets of Dartmouth, and one of our cadets was so frightened in the darkness that instead of the usual challenge, "Who goes there?" he shouted out, "There he goes." Well, then it went on again. It was quite farcical because somebody had the idea that the Germans would invade Dartmouth, which of course was quite absurd because it is a very narrow entrance to the harbour. It's a nice harbour when you get there. Slapton Sands nearby, where they trained D-Day troops, would have been far better. Anyway, a 6-inch gun was installed at Dartmouth Castle at the entrance to the estuary, and the gun, incidentally, had been got out of cold storage and had been made by the Japanese. However, some ammunition had been found for it, and we were detailed off to man it. So we went there with our gunner's mate instructor. We lived under canvas. It was most beautiful weather. We enjoyed it thoroughly. We were supplied with Cornish pasties from the college and loved it. But, I mean, it would have taken one Stuka, two bombs to wipe us out completely because the ammunition was all stored under a canvas covering. There was no armour or anything like that. It was quite absurd. And they also installed a torpedo tube, which torpedoes are meant to fire from across Dartmouth to Kingswell. Well, I mean, the whole thing was absolutely absurd.
So I can imagine, just imagine Dartmouth Harbour full of all those French vessels and Belgian vessels and so on.
Absolutely.
How extraordinary. Yeah. Did you talk at all to any of these people, you know?
Oh, no.
Boy French,
no. Well, we never came across them at all. It was a very difficult time for our captain because he became NOIC, Naval Officer in Charge of Dartmouth. So he really had to command quite a section of coastline, probably a thing he'd never done in his life before, rather more an army thing than for the Navy to do. And so not only did he command the college, but he had to do that as well.
So you left Dartmouth College?
I left the college at the end of July 1940 and was given 6 weeks' leave. And
what did you do in that time?
Oh, I just went home and enjoyed myself. Lots of dances, pretty girls, and riding and tennis and so on. It was just like pre-war. But the Navy was very good in that you were asked when you left Dartmouth who you would like to go to sea with and what ship you would like to go in. That was really quite nice. And so I had a friend called John Cardew, who was a doctor's son from Cheltenham. And he and I opted to go to the cruiser Kent. The reason was that there were two reasons, actually. We thought that the county-class cruisers, which Kent was one, were large ships and comfortable, and we'd also heard she was in the Mediterranean. And so we thought that would be rather pleasant. So we opted for that. Can you stop the...
I can, yes. Right.
And so, just at the time of the Battle of Britain was starting, which I suppose was early September 1940, a missive arrived on our doorstep, which was couched in the usual extraordinary language employed by the Admiralty, which would have read, "Sir, I am commanded by my Lord's Commissioners of the Admiralty to appoint you as midshipman to HMS Kent. Joining instructions are herewith. I am, sir, your obedient servant, O. Murray, Secretary to the Board." And that was the way that they appointed you. And I had instructions to report to the Gladstone Dock. No, I'm sorry, to... Derby House, Liverpool, on, I think it was September the 8th. There, my parents came up with me to Liverpool, and we stayed at the Adelphi Hotel, which was a very comfortable railway hotel, and then we went to Derby House the next day. And there, to our great surprise, came a small figure wearing the uniform of a Commodore R&R. And it was a great friend of my pals called Rear Admiral Crichton, who had been recalled to be one of the Commodores of Convoys. And by the greatest good luck, he told my parents he was going to be the Commodore of my convoy. And he said, "You can go away for the weekend because the Germans have dropped mines at the entrance to the Mersey and we can't go out." So my parents were very glad to have me as a, you know, just for another weekend. And we went to great friends in Knutsford called Norham. He was the Norwegian consul in Manchester, and they'd been great friends for years. And I had a great friend called Max Norum, and so we spent a very nice weekend together. Well, then we had to go back to Liverpool on the Monday morning, and we went to the Gladstone dock, where there was a huge ship waiting called the Dominion Monarch. Now, she was a lovely ship. She had been one of the latest ships which had been built for the Shaw Savile line, which had been in operation from the United Kingdom to Australia and New Zealand. It was only her fifth voyage, and therefore she was as new. And my mother made a very tearful farewell to me, and my father could hardly hide his emotion. Then we went on board. As a slight digression, 3 days out at sea, I wondered if my luggage was on board. And I waited to see that it was hoisted on board, but thank goodness it had been. Otherwise, there was somebody whose luggage did not go on board, and of course he had a terrible time without any uniform or anything like that.
What was it like coming on board that, your first ship, HMS Kent? I mean, how did they deal with you? Because you didn't really know where to go or what to do. Or what
route. There's a story.
Who instructed you?
Do you want to go round the Cape or not?
Yeah, we like it all, yes. We really would like
okay,
it all.
Okay, so, well, we have to go out in the Dominion Monarch.
Right. Okay. I see you went off in the Dominion Monarch.
Yes, because, you see, I didn't know where the camp was.
Oh, right.
And, of course, in wartime, they didn't tell you. We left Liverpool, went out a long way westwards to avoid U-boats, which were starting to operate from the Bay of Biscay, and then turned south, and we called in at Freetown, which was delightful.
What did you see in Freetown? Were you allowed off there, or...?
No, we weren't allowed off there, and what was so frightful was that... the Britannic, an old Cunard liner in which Admiral Crichton was as Commodore, she had got oil into her water tanks. And so the wretched people who were on board her drank water which was still contaminated with oil. It was quite frightful. And they could only clean them when we got to Cape Town. And arrival at Cape Town, we were 5 ships, the Andes, I think it was, Dominion Monarch, Britannic, and 2 other big ships. They were what were called WS convoys, Winston Specials. And by that time, although we didn't know it, Churchill had information in his possession, which had come through Enigma, being decrypted at Bletchley. And so he knew that the invasion of England was off. So he took this great gamble of sending tanks all the way round the Cape to reinforce the 7th Army in the Western Desert. And we had a lot of gunners on board, Army gunners, and all the other ships had the same. So really he was denuding Britain because he knew that at that time it was safe to do so.
Did you have any contact with these army people?
Oh, indeed. Yes, 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 we did. But life on board was marvellous. It was just like, peacetime cruise. And you had wonderful meals, waited on by a steward. The only thing I hated was that there wasn't enough fresh water for a bath. So what you had was a seawater bath, and you had a tub of fresh water in which to lather your soap. We midshipmen were detailed to keep lookout for submarines until we got to Freetown, and then we were allowed we did nothing else. We just had the run of the ship. That was fabulous. And then when we got to Cape Town, which was quite lovely, and I'll never forget it, because, you see, we'd had a year of blackout. And nobody who's not lived through the blackout can ever envisage it. It was so awful not being able to show a light at all. And then when you darkness came in Cape Town, there were all these lights twinkling and so on. It was absolutely fabulous. And we stood in the middle of Adderley Street, which is the main street in Cape Town, and just drank lights in.
I'll stop you just there.
Yeah.
Adrian Holloway, end of reel one.